Tale of Two Kingdoms, December 9th, 2001, number 49. I can't believe you got one of those vehicles that hurt you. Okay, well, having spent a lot of the past 2 days at the intensive care units of the Stillwater Medical Center and the Integrus Baptist Hospital, and having spent even more time driving back and forth to Oklahoma City twice, I may seem a bit addled today, but that's okay because this is probably one of the more addled sections of Scottish church history. So, if you're, I guess another way of looking at it is if you're unclear after this morning's session what happened, you can ask yourself, well, was it Jeff or was it the history? Yeah. Okay, well, last time, after being defeated at Preston Moor in England, the Engagers had been overthrown by a Covenanter government. Shortly thereafter, Charles I was executed, and the Scottish Parliament indignantly proclaimed Charles II to be king. After all, who were these English killing our king, you know? Negotiations with Charles went on through 1649 into the spring and early summer of 1650, and the chief sticking point was Charles's willingness to subscribe the national covenant and the solemn league and covenant. Okay, so we left off last time with Charles having subscribed these on a ship in the mouth of the River Spey, and he gave this oath, which included other matters such as, you know, including his worship and even his family's worship. Some of the Covenanters realized then, and some realized later, that he had no intention of keeping his word. He's merely trying to get his kingdom back. So, after he signed the covenants, took the oath, he was allowed then to set foot in Scotland, and he marched overland through Aberdeen, Donnitar, Kinnaird, St. Andrews, reaching Falkland on the 5th of July, 1650. In the meantime, there were a number of other things happening. The English Parliament didn't fail to notice what was happening in Scotland. As we heard last time, right, Bailey was afraid of sending his letters because the English Republic had posted a man of war where they were intercepting their communications. And so that they were aware. They recalled Cromwell from Ireland, where he had defeated an Irish rebellion, Royalist rebellion. And he returned to England, where he organized an army to fight the Scots. He actually tried to get Lord Fairfax to command the army, but Fairfax refused. If I remember right, I think Fairfax was a Presbyterian. He's also about ready to go into retirement. So, anyways, Cromwell marched north. He crossed the Tweed on the 22nd of July, 1650. 90 years out of sync there. He came with a force of 10,500 infantry and 5,500 cavalry. He was also supported by a naval squadron, which sailed right into the Firth of Forth, on the north side of Edinburgh. Also, at the same time, the Act of Classes was being enforced. The Covenanters purged the army, removing all, quote, men of a scandalous conversation and of questionable integrity and affection in the cause of God. And one estimate is that about 5,000 men were drummed out of the army. So, and this is... Leslie's force was somewhere around 20,000, 23,000 at the next battle. So, I mean, it was a significant number. It wasn't like half, but it was quite a few. But it robbed the army not only just of numbers. I mean, they weren't just drumming out, you know, rank inexperienced privates, but all levels. So it certainly was problematic from a morale perspective, and this has often been blamed for the Covenanters' loss at Dunbar. On the other hand, Cromwell apparently carried out the same policy in his army, and he had a very formidable, well-disciplined army. So, can't really neglect the English experience there, then. Okay, that fall, the Commission of the General Assembly deposed a number of ministers and teachers who had vices incompatible with their offices, as well as doubtful characters whose chief fault seems to earn preference for the royalist policy. That's according to Hewison. During July and August, the Covenanters worked over the king with a lot of preaching and long prayers and that sort of thing. As time went on, they put more conditions on him. On the 13th of August, the Church of the Estates both passed a resolution declaring quote, that the Kirking kingdom would only fight for the settled cause of the covenant, disclaimed the sins of the royal house, who would not own the king or his interest unless he subordinated himself to God, prosecuted their holy aims in a holy manner, and repudiated the enemies of the covenant. One of the problems they had was that a number of the covenanters had, of course, a whole range of positions, and there were some that were pretty extreme, and this was partly to placate some of the more extreme ones who basically wouldn't fight unless they were assured of the what they were fighting for. A few days later, apparently afraid that Cromwell and the Scottish army possibly deserting him and handing him over to Cromwell, Charles II signed this declaration at Dunfermline. Let's see, this is sort of a long quote from Hewison explaining it, but its seven heads bore that Charles humbled himself for his father's opposition to the work of God and to the covenants, and for the idolatry, especially of his mother, right, who was a Catholic, in the royal household, acknowledged that he had no crooked design in signing the covenant, would have no friends except covenanters, annulled the Irish treaty that had been responsible for this Irish rebellion, would encourage trading by sea, would promote the covenant in England and Ireland, would pass an act of oblivion for all except obstructors of the Reformation, traitors and regicides, and would advise the well-affected English to help the covenanters in preference to the sectaries. I'm sure the well-affected ones would listen to that. Okay, before he signed it, Patrick Gillespie, who is the brother of George Gillespie, and was also a minister in Glasgow, warned Charles that if he was not satisfied in his soul and conscience, beyond all hesitation, of the righteousness of the subscription, he was so far from overdriving him to ruin upon that as he obtested him, yea, he charged him in his master's name and the name of those who sent him, not to subscribe this declaration, no, not for the three kingdoms. Mr. Gillespie, replied the king, Mr. Gillespie, I am satisfied with the declaration, therefore will subscribe it. As Mike's pointed out, sometimes, you know, Christians tend to be
gullible.
Yeah, exactly the right word. And in the case of Gillespie, I mean, I think he knew that he was lying, but that in the end,
No,
I think he did care, but it was still very hard to deal with somebody who lies. You know,
yeah.
You know, because
it is today.
I mean, look at the problems we had with our most recent monarch.
It even is in the church.
Yeah. Keeps lying. Yeah. Okay. At the same time, Charles was writing letters elsewhere that contradicted the representations he made to, say, Gillespie. A few quotes from his letters. Let's see. However, I am forced by the necessity of my affairs to appear otherwise, yet that I am a true child of the Church of England and still remain firm unto my first principles. Mr. King, I am a true cavalier. Another one is, nothing could have confirmed me more to the Church of England than being here seeing their hypocrisy. So, at the same time, he's swearing all this stuff, he's writing these letters telling him that he's telling other people. There's... You know, and I don't know to what extent, but there's always rumors. Of course, he was also communicating with the Pope and so on. You know, so there are all these things going swirling around, and some people saying, well, he'd really been confirmed as a Catholic, and hard to say. I think, you know, it's hard to imagine him having. He says he remains firm unto his first principles. That's probably true, since his first principle seems to be taking care of Charles. Let's see. Okay, Hetherington summarized the situation as follows. There were then, as there always have been, two great parties of public men. The one composed of those who judge and act according to principle, the other of those who are guided by expediency. The first, led by P. Gillespie, J. Guthrie, S. Rutherford, and Warriston, were anxious not to press the king to the subscription of the covenant till they should have some evidence that he was in such a state of mind as might render it in him indeed a religious act, correspondent to the nature of the solemn obligation which it involved. Let's see. To read a little more. Yeah, some real repentance, though. The Actually, shortly thereafter, they were to see a lot of repentance by all these engagers. They were to go repent in the church, you know, but it obviously wasn't a true repentance. Yeah. Till that time, they were perfectly willing that he should be their king, but should remain as much as possible aloof from all intercourse with profane and irreligious men. The other party thought it inexpedient to be so strict. They considered it enough if the king should subscribe the covenant literally, however little his mind might be accordant with its spirit, not apparently perceiving that this would be an act of profane impiety to which they could not hope the blessing of God to be given. Their worldly prudence suggested to them the absolute necessity of a complete national union to resist the formidable invasion of the dreaded Cromwell. But they failed to perceive that a union not of principle but of compromise can never be firm and permanent. They were willing to tamper with the sacredness of an oath in order to frame a political bond, and by this unhallowed expedient they forfeited the protection of him whose covenant they thus profaned. They ought to have remembered that the covenant of 1638, which had proved an ark of safety in a not less stormy sea of troubles, was sacredly guarded as far as possible from being subscribed by any of whose purity of character and devotion to the cause suspicions were entertained. The one party, in short, viewed all political and national transactions through the clear medium of religion, and therefore saw them in their true character and aspect. The other viewed religion itself through the turpid and warping medium of political expediency, and therefore saw neither religion nor politics in their true nature, bearing value and reciprocal influences. It may be that the strictly religious party were too rigidly severe, but unquestionably their error was immeasurably less than that of those who, following the suggestions of short-sighted human policy, urged upon the king an oath which for him to take was perjury in the very act, and the inevitable consequences of which were an impious or impious mockery of heaven and the putting of power into the hands of men by whom it was certain to be abused. So, hindsight is, as we say, 20/20. So. So, David Leslie was the commander of the Scottish army. He was an experienced general. It was somewhat weakened by the purging, but he still had a fairly large army. They were suffering from some division over the purging. Hewison says the Scottish army was miserably rent by factious parties, and military discipline had suffered severely in consequence of the loss of unity caused by the constant purging process and the growth of divisive views of the situation. As you can imagine, it's not exactly, or the purging process can be demoralizing, you know, as they, you know, take out commanders and people you fight with and so on. Leslie's strategy was to strip the countryside of any food and supplies and let Cromwell, let hunger and disease work on Cromwell's troops until he was sufficiently weakened. And according to one author, this was based on Leslie's knowledge that his own troops were less well-trained and disciplined than Cromwell's. So I think this will come up, but one thing you have to keep in mind from a human standpoint is Cromwell's new model army had... very well disciplined, so and a lot of the Scottish army were sort of raw, you know, farm hands that just came in and didn't know how to use a rifle. Muskets, I think. I really don't know the whole thing. Probably a whole combination. I've got an account of the battle here in a little bit, so. Okay, they first met on the 29th of July, and Leslie repulsed Cromwell's forces. Charles watched the first skirmish from a distance, and some of the Covenanters worried that his presence would, quote, light the Holy Army. This is really a king you can get behind, isn't it? But that's okay. I'm quite sure that some of our own military felt the same way about our last president.
He took everything off the ship, so he didn't.
Yeah, that's right. He stripped them of their provisions. Okay, well, during the month of August, the two armies maneuvered, Cromwell ultimately trying to get the better position than retreating. On the 1st of September, Cromwell found himself with only 11,000 men. So 4,000, 5,000? Yeah, I think 5,000 had succumbed to dysentery and hunger and various illnesses and so on.
Leslie's strategy is working.
Oh, Leslie's strategy is working great. If he could have just held on a little longer, it seems like it should have worked. But as we'll see, it didn't. On the 1st of September, Cromwell found himself with these 11,000 men, and he was trapped between the mountains and the sea in Dunbar, which is east of Edinburgh. And he wrote to one of his commanders that the new model army would need a miracle to escape. Well, he got it. And this is from a book called British Battles, The Front Lines of History in Color Photographs.
Let's see the color photographs of the Battle of Dunbar.
Right there. This is it's full of photographs of these reenactments. It's a pretty good book, actually. I mean, short accounts of the battles. Now, this is it's common. A number of writers actually blame the defeat on the ministers directly. So then the unexpected happened. The ministers of the Scottish Kirk, convinced they had got God on their side, compelled Leslie to abandon the blockade and launch an all-out attack. At around 4 p.m. on the 2nd of September, Cromwell was surveying the enemy lines when he discerned through his glass an extraordinary movement in the Scottish camp. This cheered him up immensely. "They are coming down," he exclaimed. "The Lord hath delivered them into our hands." That same night, in the utter darkness of a rainstorm which had blown in off the sea, he prepared a surprise attack. Cannons and dragoons were deployed to engage the Scottish left, while the bulk of the army filed across the deep Broxburn ravine towards Leslie's right wing. The English vanguard went in before sunrise, spearheaded by General Lambert's cavalry and seconded by General Monk with three infantry regiments. Although they were successfully contained by the Scottish horse, thundering down with their lancers in their front ranks, it was to no avail. Almost before the Scots could draw a breath, Cromwell had put the second part of his plan into action. On the previous day, he noticed that Leslie's right wing was so cramped for space between the mountains behind and the ravine in front that they had not great ground to traverse the regiments or wheel about. Seizing upon this weakness, he now led his own cavalry regiment of Ironsides, together with a regiment of foot, in a crushing flank attack. Although some of the Scottish infantry put up a tenacious resistance, many were disordered by their own horse, which routed through their lines. Even as their embattled ranks began to crumble, the Presbyterian ministers among them continued to preach, assuring the Scots that God would grant them success, quote, "till the English were upon them, and some of their preachers were knocked in the head whilst they were promising victory," unquote. As Cromwell pushed forward, the morning sun suddenly broke through the clouds to bounce off a silvery sea. Inspired by this omen, he cried, "Now let God arise, and his enemies shall be scattered." Without ceasing the busy rhythm of their blades, his regiments pressed their flank attack steadily home, rolled up the Scottish right, until at last Cromwell's voice boomed out again, "I profess they run." Then, as the last pockets of Scottish infantry threw down their arms and fled, he halted his men and sang the 17th Psalm. The worst of the fighting was over in about an hour. While the speed and lethal effectiveness of the English flank attack had preserved Cromwell's army almost intact, 3,000 Scots were listed killed and 10,000 captured.
Wow, he
rolled up the whole army and the rest fled. That's what happened.
There's not much left. Just about got them all.
Well, I think there were 23,000 Scots altogether. But considering 3,000 killed, 10,000 captured, of those, most of those died too later, just due to poor conditions. Some of them were released. I think he let 5,000 go, but the 5,000 were marched back in England, and within a few months there were only 1,000 left or something. You know, they just
explains how general the
yeah. So I was going to say another. This is another account from a book by Philip Warner. Yeah, it's copyright 1975. It's called Famous Scottish Battles. And just to read this little part, unfortunately for Leslie, he was accompanied by a number of fanatical clergy who were extreme even by Civil War standards. On the next day, as dawn broke, they clustered around Leslie and urged him to charge down on the defenseless English, who were now well in the trap, and sweep them into the sea. The Lord hath delivered Antichrist into our hands, and like Gideon, you should descend on them and sweep them away before you, they told him. With astonishing stupidity, Leslie listened to what they said and apparently acted on it. Then he goes on. There may, however, have been certain military considerations in his decision, for Cromwell was no novice, and it was not out of the question that he might hold up Leslie's front line while the remainder of his army slipped past. So, anyway, so that's sort of typical. They're to blame the ministers, you know. Another historian, Roger Hainsworth, offers a different interpretation. This is book The Swordsman and Power of War and Politics Under the English Republic, 1649-1660. Why did Cromwell win? The legend is that he won because Leslie abandoned the high ground at the urgings of the Presbyterian clergy and descended to where Cromwell could get at him. This will not do. Cromwell was not besieging Leslie on his mountain. It was the other way around. Had Leslie remained where he was a day or so longer, his own army would have deteriorated further, and once desertion gathered steam, it would have been unstoppable. Disease was already at work among his exposed and hungry men. You cannot defeat an enemy by sitting on a mountain and looking at him. He had trapped his enemy, but to take him, he had to descend and engage. He had to concentrate on his right wing because that was where the only escape route to Berwick passed for the English troops. Cromwell demonstrated beyond all doubt that he was a, quote, master of the field by perceiving that the conformation of the battlefield could be turned to his advantage. Anyways, he goes on to explain why Cromwell could win. Maybe a couple other things are of interest here. The numerical inferiority of Cromwell's cavalry and infantry was counterbalanced by their superior quality. The Ironsides were soldiers, not civilians clad in buff coats. Too many of the Scottish army had been snatched from their farms and trades, unfamiliar with their weapons, commanded by strangers. It could be said of them as Churchill said of the Kaiser's men. It was not their fault. It was their fate. Anyways. Dunbar was actually Cromwell's sort of crowning victory. It wasn't his last victory as a commander, but he... what was a major defeat of another Protestant army. It was a defeat against what were considered to be very long odds, against greatly poor tactical positions, and low numbers. And he interpreted his miraculous victory as God's approval of his cause. The victory had political fallout in both countries, and this is fairly important. It truly changed the situation. Again, quoting from Roger Hainsworth, in England, the Presbyterians, held in check by the military control of the independents, but still a formidable if frustrated force within the Commonwealth, were now discredited. The prestige of the Commonwealth government had never stood higher. The, quote, Lord of Hosts had been the watchword of the Ironside army at Dunbar, and it appeared that he did indeed confound their enemies. In Scotland, the defeat had a shattering impact. While the extremists among the clergy and the Kirk party blamed David Leslie, and any among his army whose orthodoxy was suspect, for the disaster rather than their own feudal policies, the Scottish people were not deceived. The prestige of the Kirk would never stand as high again during the lifetime of the survivors of Dunbar. Never again would the extreme covenanting party produce statesmen and generals, conjure armies into existence, or seek to compel the religious orthodoxy of the English. In the short term, they would vainly resist compromise in the creation of a true royalist army. In the long term, they had to endure the conquest of Scotland by an English army of heretic independents, and when the Ironsides passed from the scene, they would be under the heel of the very monarch they had sought to use as the tool of their sectarian ambitions, and who had vivid memories of the humiliations they had heaped on him and on his martyred father. Now, that's a critical assessment, but factually, I think the fact that they never again enjoyed the sort of prestige and, the political influence, that's, true. So, basically, the class, it's all downhill from here. Right. Whatever high points there were. So... Rutherford also wrote at this time, let's see, Well, according to Rutherford's biographer, Coffee, the victory threw into confusion all his firm convictions about God's providential purpose. "Oh, how little of God do we see, and how mysterious is he," he wrote to Colonel Gilbert Kerr. To a fellow minister, William Guthrie, he confessed, "I have suffered much, but this is the thickest darkness and the straightest step of the way I have yet trodden. Alas, alas, poor I am, utterly lost. My share of heaven is gone, and my hope is poor. I am perished, and I am cut off from the Lord. I profess that I am almost broken and a little sleepy, and would fain put off this body." Coffee also points out that Cromwell later experienced something like this when the English expedition to Hispaniola was defeated in July of 1655. But let's see. In September 1650, Rutherford also sought to identify the source of provocation. He concluded that Scotland had been defeated at Dunbar because of her unfaithfulness to the covenants, her easy acceptance of malignants, not least Charles II. "I am abundantly satisfied that our army, though through the sinful miscarriage of men, hath fallen," he told Colonel Kerr on 5th of September. Dunbar signaled not God's favor towards the sectaries, but his displeasure at the Scots for tolerating those who had broken the covenant. "The army was not," quote, "Gideon's 300 by whom he is to save us. We must have one of our Lord's carving." What was needed, therefore, was further purging. Covenantal logic eschewed the, quote, "trust in God and keep your powder dry" approach. Rutherford, who had so often explained how God worked through second causes and called upon men to make use of means, now claimed that the obvious means, a larger army must be thrown aside because it inhibited reliance on God. Gideon and Samson had achieved their victories not because of natural strength, but because the breathings of the Spirit of the Lord came upon them. Rutherford hinted strongly that Kerr would be given a similar empowerment. "If I conceive right, the Lord hath called you to act against the enemy. Ye are, sir, to lay hold on opportunities of providence and to wait for him." So, for better or for worse, and sort of the approach the Covenanters took to it, this devastating defeat of the Scottish forces at Dunbar led to further division among the troops. Two colonels, Strachan and Kerr, the one that Rutherford is writing to here, who one writer called the Gideons of the extreme party, refused to serve further under Leslie, publicly accusing him of losing the battle. Many ministers thought the problem was obvious, since the army still had too many malignants in it and answers further purging. On the other hand, a more royalist-leaning party, including the king, thought it best to relax the act of classes and draw as many men possible into the army. They brought some proposals to a committee of the estates in Stirling. Their proposals became known as the public resolutions. Soon, two parties arose, the Furret and Agenet party. Yeah, those who are Furret and those who are Agenet. Yeah. Okay, and the party in favor of the resolutions were often called the Resolutioners. The opposing party were known as the Protesters, sometimes occasionally called Remonstrators. They wrote this remonstrance, but which is a protest. So, the Commission of the General Assembly, which was dominated by James Guthrie, Patrick Gillespie, Samuel Rutherford, and Archibald Johnston, met in Stirling, and they issued a short declaration and warning on September 12th. It, quoting Hewison, "urged all parties to search for the iniquities which had provoked God to visit Scotland with his wrath, and summoned the king to mourn for the provocations of his guilty father and himself, as well as to consider if his hypocritical acceptance of the covenant in order to gain an earthly crown was not another sin depriving him of a heavenly crown." They then issued another document called "Causes of a Solemn Public Humiliation upon the Defeat of the Army, to be kept throughout all the congregations of the Kirk of Scotland." This was to be read from the pulpits throughout the land. It contained 13 points along the lines of, you know, why the army was defeated, what the sins had been. It also blamed the problem. In addition to those, the ones we mentioned before, blamed problems on the homecoming of the malignants, failure to rid the country of them, and on the crooked ways of some negotiators sent to Holland. Okay. However, these protests were not universally welcomed. Some churches refused to read them from the pulpit. Some ministers went even further, demanding that the public servants that had repented of their sins should be restored to their civil offices, before the period stipulated by the Act of Classes. And so there actually started to be a public, further public sentiment that the Act of Classes be revoked or modified. The king certainly became weary of the treatment he was receiving. After describing the endless hours of prayers and sermons, hearing six on one occasion, observing Sabbaths indoors, and card playing and dancing forbidden, Hewison tells us that these months of penance made an ineffaceable impression on the young king's mind and confirmed him in his hatred of Presbyterianism. When, after the Battle of Worcester, Charles appeared in France, Orleans told him that it was reported that he had gone back to Scotland. Charles replied, "I had rather been hanged." He was apparently worried that he might be turned over to Cromwell, so he started also, in addition to that, he decided to take action on his own. He started meeting with Royalist supporters, and on the 4th of October 1650, he made a break for it, reminiscent of James just, escaping his captivity. A few days later, he had to give himself up. He was returned to what you might call protective custody in a few days. But the Committee of States was also somewhat concerned and made effort to include the king in their deliberations. But some of the royalists weren't so easily put down. They claimed they were simply making a plea for national unity. They wrote their own bond or covenant that they signed. They transmitted this to Leslie, the king, and the Committee of States. And soon after they did this, the King and the Committee of States published an act of pardon and indemnity, which pardoned them on the condition that they lay down their arms. These would have been mostly men that would have been prohibited from serving by the Act of Classes. I think they were had been followers of Montrose. This was too much for many of the Covenanters, particularly those from Western Scotland. Strachan and Kerr, who had refused to serve under Leslie, they raised their own Covenanted army of 4,000 men. Basically coming from Southwest or Western Scotland, where Rutherford had been years before. They held a conference in Dumfries in October 1650, and they formulated a formal complaint, which is called the Remonstrance, and it was sent to the Committee of Estates. These are extracts from the Remonstrance, and this isn't the whole thing, but this comes from the Source Book of Scottish History, edited by Dickinson and Donaldson. To the Right Honorable, the Committee of Estates, the humble remonstrance of the gentlemen, commanders, and ministers attending the forces in the West. Although we do not judge of the undertakings of the Lord's people by the success, and be not shaken by the dissipating of our army, I think they were shaken, but okay. Nor brought in question our cause, yet we think ourselves and all the people of this land called by these late dispensations to search and try our ways. We do therefore esteem it our duty, freely and faithfully, to make our thoughts known to your lordships concerning the causes and remedies of the Lord's indignation which hath gone out against his people, wherein we suppose we need not insist upon the late sins contained in the late causes of the fast, published by the commissioners of the Kirk, relating to the conduct and carriage of our army and other things. But we shall speak to that which most directly concerns your lordships. That which is obvious in the first place, among the sins of the land, is our late proceedings with the king, wherein, that we be not mistaken, we shall distinguish betwixt our duty and our sins. We owe and acknowledge for our duty to use all lawful ways and means for reclaiming the king, and to own his interest according to our vocation, so far as he owns and prosecutes the cause. But we are convinced it is our sin, the sin of the kingdom, that when the king had walked in the ways of his fathers, opposition to the work of reformation, and the solemn league and covenant, that after all this, commissioners should have been warranted to assure him of his present admission to the exercise of his royal power, upon his profession to join in the cause and covenant, not only without any further evidence of his repentance unto the renewing of the Lord's controversy with his father's house, and without convincing evidences of the reality of his profession and his forsaking his former principles and ways, but when there was pregnant presumptions, if not clear evidences of the contrary. We beseech your lordships to consider whether in God's sight, who will not be mocked with declarations contrary to intentions, there be no just cause to charge some eminent persons in our councils and forces with such engagements and designs to invade England for the enforcing of the king upon that nation and for enriching themselves with their spoils. That was actually the next strategy. Once the king got sort of further seated in power, they did march into England. But in the next place, the great mother sin of this nation we conceive to be the backsliding breach of covenant engagements unto the Lord. So we humbly desire your lordships to lay to heart how unanswerable ye have walked to your solemn engagement to purge the judicatories and armies, and to fill the places of trust and power with men of known good affection to the cause of God and of a blameless and Christian conversation. Have not some amongst you been the chief obstructors of the work by retarding conclusions, by studying to make them ineffectual when they have been taken, by your partial dealing, differencing men according to their interests, countenancing, favoring, keeping in, and helping to places of power and trust such malignant and profane persons as might be subservient to your designs, by your reckoning it qualification good enough if a man be free of accession to the engagement, though he were otherwise malignant or profane, by your sparing of those in eminent places and trust in the judicatories and armies, and taking no trial of the qualifications according to your vows, while you were doing some duty upon them of lower degree, whereby it hath come to pass that there remain yet spots in your judicatories, which diminishes your credit and authority, and occasion is given to the enemies to blaspheme the cause of God. So, I don't know how long the original remonstrance was, but they tried to, you know, give us a summary of it, but I think, you know, it's pretty consistent with what we've seen so far in terms of blaming this on the sins of the government, I guess you could say, in bringing back some people. It's pretty clear that even though they passed this act of classes, some people had gotten, some malignants had gotten into positions of authority, or at least the influence. Well, even within the protester party, there were a range of opinions. Strachan decided later that any possibility of joining with the king was a mistake, and he went over to Cromwell. Patrick Gillespie later became good friends with Cromwell. He declared that a hypocrite ought not to reign over us, that we ought to treat with Cromwell and give him security not to trouble England with the king. The Committee of the States, after conferring with the Commission of the General Assembly, resolved to suppress the remonstrance. This wasn't unanimous. Argyle and three other members are noted as being loud in disapproval of it as a divisive, scandalous, and treasonable production. Three other members, including, not surprisingly, Archibald Johnston of Warriston, defended it. But nevertheless, they voted to suppress it. The Commission of the General Assembly met on the 28th of November, 1650, and admitted that the remonstrance contained sad truths apt to breed division in Kirk and Kingdom, but they deferred further criticism until the framers of the remonstrance had an opportunity to further explain their views. The Scottish Parliament started meeting at the same time, and they commissioned Colonel Robert Montgomery to put down the Western remonstrators, this 4,000-strong covenanted army. But he never had a chance. On the 30th of November and 1st of December, that night, they were overwhelmed by an English Commonwealth army commanded by General Lambert. He'd been the cavalry commander in the Battle of Dunbar. Colonel Kerr was captured and sent to an English prison, where he was consoled by letters from Samuel Rutherford. I don't know how well, I'm not sure how bad the prison was, but Strachan tried to rally the remaining forces, but he finally surrendered to Cromwell. The year ended with the Castle of Edinburgh being captured by Cromwell on Christmas Eve, 1650. So to conclude, referring to the resolution or protest or conflict, Hetherington says, from this time forward, the two parties in the church were known by the names of resolutioners and protesters, the former being those who were carried away by the secular and prudential views of expediency, the latter, the uncompromising adherents of the covenant. Many of the resolutioners were men of great piety and worth, but somewhat deficient in firmness and decision of character. Lovers of peace to such an extent as to be willing to sacrifice some of their own principles for its attainment. Of these, David Dixon was one. But some years afterwards, when the perfidy of Charles and the malignants had become evident, he on his deathbed acknowledged his error and admitted that the protesters had seen these matters in a truer light than the resolutioners had done. On the other hand, there is reason to believe that the protesters injured their own good cause by the somewhat intemperate vehemence of this proceedings. So I give you that with one disclaimer, which is these deathbed changes of heart are sometimes hard to really know if they're really true. You recall the Episcopalians claimed Alexander Henderson had changed his mind and accepted bishops at the end. But anyways, I think that's a good summary of the cause. So if you ever wonder about just how relevant this all is, just consider our own situation here. We just recently had a president that reminds us very much of Charles II. And the Scots had this sort of three-way battle between the sectaries on the one hand and the malignants on the other, loyalists and the Presbyterian party. And in our own times we have this, you might think of us having a battle between Islam, Christianity, and secularists. Right? And in our own nation you can see this going back and forth, you know. So what lessons we should learn from that? Well, I don't know, we'll probably have to pay extra for that. So okay, are there any questions? Mr. Edmondson.
It appears that the Scots were totally convinced that they were the righteous and that the English Cromwell were not righteous, because, you know, they're losing. They said the reason we lost was that God was mad at us, not because Cromwell was more righteous than them.
Right.
So forth and so on. It seems that these continually battle losses, so forth and so on, they would always say, I've lost because I was at Crossways of God or something like that, so forth and so on. Is that a proper way to look at victories and losses in battle?
Well, I think by the... I guess one of my points was that Cromwell looked at his victory and said that, you know, obviously he was victorious because God favored his cause, and the Scots looked at his victory and said, well, he was victorious because God didn't favor our cause. or actually maybe they favored our cause, but he didn't, you know, that we had too many malignants in the army. I think that's always one of the problems of analyzing history and our own strivings and so on, is, you know, if we're tempted to put this kind of spin we'd like to put on it. You know, it does seem to me that the Scots, you know, probably, certainly in human terms, that one of their problems was their sort of inexperienced army.
But had they in previous history used their experienced army very well? I mean, look at the
Well, that's true, and that does lead to, I mean, there is a lot to be said for morale.
You're always very ad hoc army, so. Whereas Cromwell's army, you know, at the end of all this,
Now, that's not to say that the battle, you know, in God's providence couldn't have turned out differently. I think, you know, obviously, I think it could have. But
I mean, it does strike me that they, not to lay the blame on the ministers, but it seems like if they were presuming to advise the general in military affairs, they were out of line. They were overreaching. I mean, they should have been caring for the flock, not trying to run the army.
Yep. I don't know how widespread that actually was, but yeah, I think that's a valid point, that they were clearly meddling in affairs beyond their, you know, if the difference between the two kingdoms means anything, when you don't want the king to run the church, then surely you shouldn't expect the church to be out there literally on the front line saying, send this, you know, this regiment down here. I mean, that, you know, God says, you know, you should destroy the...
Yeah. I mean, as I was listening to it, it almost sounded like these guys were charismatic, you know. You know, the minister says, thus saith the Lord, go marry that person. You know, I don't know.
Well, when we get into later...
It sounds like they had abandoned some of their own tenets.
Well, I think they had. Yeah, I think sometimes they get into problems like this whole resolution or protest or controversy because they were largely running the church with this commission of the General Assembly. And that always leads to the possibility, I guess, that even though maybe the commission, you know, is godly men and their positions, they're well thought out biblically, etc., that also always leads to the possibility that they're sort of overrunning the rest of the ministers. And the rest of the ministers may not see it that way, and I think that's one of the things we can see happening, so that... you know, maybe they should have spent more time in persuasion. So, Dave.
One of the complaints that Congressman Hyde had with regard to term limits, he said that it would produce a body of people who were a bit naive politically into an environment in which that would not be an asset. Now, granted, it's not trying to argue for or against term limits here, but one of the things that is clear, at least in my own thinking, hearing this history and all the political trouble and turmoil I had, is that establishing solid political ground and understanding the right thing to do and forming consensus is not an easy thing to do. And it's easy to think that because you're a Christian, you're automatically qualified to do those things. And it appears that it's not that easy to form a political consensus in a government. And these guys had a great deal of difficulty in doing so. They appear to be, at times, very naive and very zealous for a particular political cause, restoring Charles, and naive enough to believe that what he said was sufficient at first to justify that. And maybe someone, I don't know, maybe someone with more political savvy, but still having a righteous disposition, might have been able to see through some of those things. But it doesn't appear to me a very easy thing to do.
Yeah. You know, in their defense, they were living at sort of the beginnings of what you might think of as democracy in general, and that, so right, and this was a big experiment, so that the way they were doing it was sort of a logical extension of the way it always been done. But in fact, Presbyterianism is something like a democracy, or you know, more accurately, a republic. You know, with representatives and hierarchical, you know, assemblies and so on. You elect the elders. The churches elect the elders. Yeah, God imposes them.
like we're teaching other and things like that, they go through seminary, they're just about automatically.
No. You could go through seminary and graduate and find no church to call you.
Yeah, but that doesn't take away your title to being.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't take away. You don't have the title.
You don't get a title until a church
looks. Right. Yeah, there's a lot of things. I think, I don't claim to have all the answers to how to apply this or what exactly all their problems were, but they, yeah, I mean, some of the things you've noted seem to me they didn't always operate true to their principles, and I guess they sometimes act in a way as if they were right, they didn't have to convince other people, and that. Yes, right. Right.
He has all his principles, you know, when he changed the poem and eventually turned the poem.
Yeah.
He was huge then, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, let's stop there.